which is awareness, the power of awareness. And we are going to explore what we mean by awareness and also some practical exercises to discover how to approach or how to tap into this power that we all have, but that we are not educated to develop. You know, we go to school and we are educated on several levels, physically, emotionally also, through the arts, although that seems not to be so important anymore for many schools. And of course, intellectually, we are taught, I don't know if we are taught how to think, we are taught what to think, but anyway, the intellectual aspect is also stimulated. And those are the tools we normally have to face life. Of course, if we are spiritual inclined people, we also have religion, and there is the aspect of faith or devotion that may help. And with these tools, we are thrown into the world and we try to deal with life. You know, sometimes life brings happiness and sometimes life brings suffering. Most people are with the idea that we can get rid of suffering, that suffering is something that is unnatural, that we all should be happy. And that's pretty much what we all are looking for in one way or the other. Some people think they are going to be happy if they have a lot of money or power, or some people may think with a great family or a great career or whatever means the person think will bring happiness. And yet we seem to be unable to find happiness in a deep sense. You know, we may be contented if we are okay financially, we don't have major problems with our family or our health, but still, especially for spiritual people, life seems to be lacking something, seems to be unsatisfactory. And then when problems come, we try to deal with them as best as we can with these tools that we were educated to use. You know, we have physical resources. There is a problem, and then we want to do something about it and try to solve it. And that's perfectly fine, but many times in solving the problem, we create new problems, not only on an individual basis, but also as a society. You know, well, I'm in the field of biology and microbiology, and I remember when studying the history of the development of science, biological sciences, in the 19th century when we discovered the bacteria and why illnesses were produced or how, scientists thought that they would be able to cure every kind of illness in a few decades. You know, it was just a question of discovering what bacteria, what antibiotic, and that was the end of it. But in developing antibiotics, we are generating bacteria that are, you know, much more powerful than the original ones. They are resistant to all these antibiotics. So in the action of trying to get rid of something, we are generating new problems. And that happens in any field. And the truth is that we are in the 21st century and we still have illnesses and, you know, we have not solved that problem. So same with politics or economics. So when there is a problem, we try to do something about it, and sometimes we can solve it momentarily. Or we may react emotionally. That happens many times. There is a challenge and we react emotionally. Many times an emotional reaction is not the smartest move, you know, and then we regret what we did when we were in the midst of an emotional reaction. But anyway, the emotions are a big part of our interaction with the world. Or intellectually, there is a problem and we think, how can I solve this? And then we try to rationalize the problem. And all these tools are fine. They may be useful, But what if there is in us a deeper faculty, a deeper ability that can solve the problems in a much more direct way? Because we are not educated to use these other resources, they seem foreign to us. But we have innate abilities that are latent. You know what? The third aim of the Theosophical Society is to explore these latent powers or abilities. And I'm not talking about psychic powers. I'm talking about abilities that we have to deal with life in a different way. But they are dormant in ourselves. So awareness, and we are going to explore in depth what this means, is something that many traditions have said to be a transformational power in ourselves. You know, you have, in today, the idea of awareness is more common for within the spiritual environment. I think in the West, the first person that started talking about this was Krishnamurti. He started talking about being aware, paying attention. Then Gurdjieff also started talking about this. And then came Hinduism and with Vedanta and Zen Buddhism and then Tibetan Buddhism. So little by little, the idea of awareness began to be more well known in the West. But yet, I find that not always there is a deep explanation of what we mean by awareness. So when we try to do this, we don't get the results that are said to be able to be produced by the practice of being aware. So I hope we can explore all that tonight. The idea is that in the Theosophical view, you know, we have our physical nature, which basically is the basis for actions. Then we have the emotional nature, which is a basis for reactions, which are necessary also in life. But if they are not under control, they can produce problems. Then we have the mental nature, which is the source of thinking. And the Theosophical view says this is not all we are. There is another aspect, a higher aspect, that we could call, let's say, intuitional. And this is the source of something that we may call insight. The definition of insight is the ability to perceive something on an intuitive level. And the definition of intuition is the perception of something in a direct way without going through a process of reasoning, of thinking. So what this is saying is that the Theosophical literature says there is in us the ability to have a direct perception into something without having to go through a process of reasoning necessarily. Sometimes that helps producing the insight. We are going to explore this. But this insight, because it's direct, reveals a deeper aspect of reality. Because if you see, for example, our physical actions are conditioned by our body. Some people have bodies that are lazy or restless or heavy or light, and that produces a limitation in our physical actions. Same with emotions and mind. We are born with a particular mental capacity. Some people are intellectually more intelligent than others. That doesn't mean that they are better or worse people or that they are happier or not than people who are less smart intellectually. Now we talk also about the emotional intelligence. So people recognize many times we have people that are very smart and yet they are unable to relate to the world. How is it possible if they are smart? So there is this idea of emotional intelligence, but emotions, mind, or thinking is conditioned. It is like looking at the world through a glass that is colored. So we look at the world with a certain emotional background. A person, because of the experiences that he or she had when young, feels that the world is threatening, you know, and that he or she has to be defensive. Or another person feels that the world should go around him or her and give everything that he or she wants. Or, you know, we have a particular emotional background, a particular intellectual background, and with that conditioning, we try to relate to the world. But the insight, the idea of the insight, is that because it is a direct perception, it's not a perception that comes through a process of reasoning or through an emotional process, it can reveal the truth of something. So every person has this power of insight in an innate way. We don't have to develop the power of insight, but we have to learn how to tap into it. Some people, this insight is more accessible than to others just because they learn how to tap into it. So the idea is that if we can start working on this level, this insight may become part of our tools, the tools that we can use to face life. And then, of course, that insight will use thinking and feeling and acting, but because there is a truer perception when it comes from the insight, then the action, the feeling, and the thinking will be closer to what is healthy, what is harmonious, what is right. So the process of tapping into this insight is, as anything in nature, gradual, but there are things that we can do, just as we can learn to think, we can learn to appreciate beauty, we can also learn to tap into this insight. So I think there are like three general states of consciousness in which a person may operate. One of them is a state where there is basically an unconscious reaction. You know, life happens, this person reacts, never asking, why am I acting in this way? Is this right? Is this fair? It's just a reaction. Something comes that produces pain and the person will try to push it away. Something comes that produces pleasure and the person will try to get it. And it doesn't matter if it is moral or not. The limitations, well, if I do this and I go to jail, I cannot do it. And I don't do it just because I will go to jail. But if I could, I would do it. So it's not that there is really a thinking of, is it right or wrong? So that's a state of consciousness, the unconscious reaction, unconscious in the sense of not self-aware. Then there is a stage in which I guess most people interested in spirituality are, which is a state of conscious action, let's say. We start trying to act more consciously. When something happens, we try to control our reactions, to direct our actions, to do the right thing, or to do what is necessary. So intentionally, we try to deal with the effects of being exposed to the environment. Now, this is a period of conflict, because usually we try to address the problem on the same level that the problem, or with the same tools that produce the problem. So, for example, there is a problem at work, or in the family, or in our personal life, and we feel emotionally and intellectually and maybe even physically threatened. So because we are aware that we shouldn't let ourselves just go into a reaction, we start trying to control our reaction, our emotions, our thinking. But we are trying to control it with our mind. The mind and the emotions is the problem because it's in this state of reaction. And the mind itself is trying to control itself. So there is a clash. There is a conflict. Now, I think that is inevitable for a while in a process of transition. But there is a different possibility. There is another state of consciousness, which comes, because here there is no conflict in the inner conflict. You know, I feel like doing this and I just do it. And I never think that I may be wrong. Everybody else is wrong. I just do it and it's the right thing to do. So, or what I wanted to do. So here there is no conflict. Here there is inner conflict. You know, oh, I did this, I shouldn't, or I should do something else. And then the part that wants to blame another and the part that recognizes our own problem or what we did. So this is a state of conflict that produces suffering. But then there is the possibility of what I would call a supraconscious, and I'll explain this, action. Supraconscious in the sense that there is an action, just like here. This is a reaction. There is no choice or anything. This is also an action. So it has something common to this state of consciousness. But it is supraconscious in the sense that the action comes from beyond our process of thinking. So at this point, there is no conflict. It's just like this in the sense that on these two levels, there is no conflict. But this one has in common with the conscious action that it is an intelligent action. It is a volitional action in a certain sense. I'm going to explain this. But, you know, this is just like if we have to solve a physical problem, like a door is locked, we can try to use, you know, brute force, or if we think and we say, oh, it's locked, we unlock it and the problem is solved. So in this case, it's the same. We can try to struggle against the problem, or there is a higher faculty that sees the root of the problem and that can solve it without the struggle. So that's the idea. This insight has the ability to produce this. So let us explore a little about the nature of this insight. One key to tap into the insight is what we call awareness. Now, awareness is the background of our being. We are always aware of something. Even if you may be aware of what I'm saying right now, or if you are distracted, you're aware of your thoughts, or you are aware of, you know, the bird that is outside. We are always aware of something. So even these people that we say they live in unconscious reaction, they are aware. But at what level are they aware? And what level of awareness is necessary to tap into this insight? At this point in human evolution, most of us and even those who may begin to tap into something else, most of the time, they are anchored in an intellectual awareness. What does it mean? For example, if you don't know Sanskrit, you know, so I write something here, you know, that's a syllable in Sanskrit. What do you see? You just see lines there. Now, if I write these lines, do you see lines? No, you see a word. Even if I write it in Spanish, Do you see lines? No, because you know the letters. You see letters, and you see a word. If you try to see this word without recognizing it as a word, just as a, you know, a collection of lines, just as you see the Sanskrit there, you'll see that it's extremely difficult to see a word without reading it, without seeing the meaning. Because we have a mechanism in our mind that conceptualizes everything. This mechanism is very good to deal with the practical life, but it is a barrier for a deeper awareness, as we are going to see. If you pay attention, this conceptualization is always there. You see an object that you don't know. So the object may have a sphere, a shape, you know, like a sphere, another part like a cube, and then like a cylinder. But for you, it's just some shapes. Now, if you know the objects, and you know that this is a ball and this is a can, you stop seeing just shapes. You see a ball, you see a can, it's very difficult to see something without the concept. I remember I was once on a bus in Argentina, and there was a person sitting in front of me, and the person was talking to somebody, so his or her ear, I don't remember, was right there in my eyes. And I was just trying to be aware, and suddenly I was surprised, because to me there was something completely different. I started seeing the ear without recognizing the ear, and it seemed so weird, so strange, until the concept of an ear came back, and I said, yeah, that's an ear. So then I experimented a little. Sometimes if we look at something for a more or less long time without thinking, we can lose the concept and see something fresh without the idea this is a year or whatever it is. But the point here is that our awareness is ingrained in a process of conceptualization. So we can never see the world unless we try to do it actively, as we are going to see. There are some exercises we can use. But we can never see the world past those concepts. And this kind of insight is something that comes when the thinking is not working. Or the thinking may be working, but our awareness is not anchored in the process of thinking. We have to be able to untie the awareness from the process of thinking, and then it will open the door for the insight. So when we read about awareness in many traditions, what I have seen in my life and talking to other people who try to practice it is that many times what we are actually doing is trying to be aware, but from the intellectual level. We don't notice it. Just as it is difficult to see these lines not as a word, it is difficult to look at ourselves without the conceptual process that is ingrained in us. So there are some, we have to try to really break through this. And for that, there are, as I said, there are several approaches you can take. This insight is talked about in many traditions. You know, well, in theosophy, sometimes it is called manas taijasa. Manas means like understanding or the mind, and taijasa means illumined. So it's an insight, is when the mind is illumined by the intuition. Or in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, I mention it in case you are familiar with that tradition, it is the Viveka Khyati. That's a power of seeing what is true and what is not true, Viveka Khyati. Or, let's see, in Zen, sometimes the idea, it differs in different schools, but the idea of Satori is this insight that allows you to see something as it is. Or in Vedanta, there is this also this idea of the, you know, witnessing, where you you see nakedly something as it is without concepts on it. So it is in many traditions. Now, let us talk about some of the conditions for this to work. For example, suppose something happens and we are angry and we don't want to react with the anger. Of course, when something good happens, we don't question it. So I'm bringing something that we usually question and try to deal with. So a person that is honest in trying to lead a spiritual path will try to do something about that anger. Maybe that person cannot do it at the moment, but then afterwards will say, I should not have done that, and what can I do? And then there are many strategies where we can use our thinking. You know, start thinking on the opposite of anger, on peace, and try to generate a state of peace. Or try to see the things from the point of view of the other person so you can understand that person. Or many strategies that are all good strategies and they bring some results. But there is a different possibility because these strategies still produce a conflict. You know, there is a conflict of what I'm feeling, what I don't want to feel. So the conflict between what I am at this moment and what I should be. And that maintains a duality, which is the basis of conflict. So there is a different approach that is devoid of conflict. And that approach is to be able to state in a state of deep awareness with whatever is there at the moment. So for example, if you are angry, you start, you know, if you have the opportunity, just go for a walk or sit in your room or the bathroom, whatever, and sit and start looking at all that movement. Now, we have to look at it without the conceptual background operating. So when we see something immediately, we say, this is right, this is wrong. I shouldn't be feeling this, or that person deserted. All those concepts will keep the awareness trapped on the intellectual level. So we have to start watching it without making any judgment. There is anger, you watch the anger. You don't try to make it go away. You don't try to change it. You don't try to manipulate it, transform it, or you don't try to express it, because when there is anger, there is this inner pressure, and we want to escape from that. Nobody likes that inner pressure. So you may escape by expressing the anger, or you may escape by trying to manipulate it and change it and make it disappear. All these strategies are done by the intellectual aspect of ourselves that wants to do something about it. So this strategy is just stay with what is there. This is difficult because we don't want to touch, to be in contact with the anger, for example, or fear, or whatever other feeling. That's the reason why we are trying to do something about it, to go away from it, either express it or repress it. So we have to have a certain courage to be able to remain in touch with that. So you remain in touch and you just watch it. And you let the emotions do whatever they want. You know, and say, because in theosophy we say, we are not the body, we are not the emotions, and we are not the mind. If you think you are the thinker, the one that thinks, then stop thinking and tell me if you can do it. If we are the ones that think, we should be able to say, now I want to think, now I don't want to think. Or same with the emotions. If we are the ones that produce the emotions, then we should be able to say, you know, I don't want to feel this, and drop it. In the theosophical view, our emotions, they have a life and a consciousness of their own. We call the emotional elemental or desire elemental. Just like the body, the cells, they have a life of their own. And, you know, I may not want to have an illness in my body, but the body is something that is alive and has its own universe and world. So in the same way, our emotions, they are living beings. And I may not want to have this emotion, but that's part of this body that I inherited. And same with thoughts. So we have to be ready to see the emotions in a completely detached way. You know, when we see the clouds going on the sky and we see dark clouds, we don't try to make them white. We may not like the dark clouds, but we know we cannot do anything about it. And yet, we think we can do something about our emotions. Now, the one that can do something about the emotions is the intellectual level. But here, remember, we are trying to go above the intellectual level. So when you are trying to manipulate your emotions, you are working on the intellectual level. The condition for this awareness to appear, this more intuitional awareness, is that you let go of your clinging to the intellectual level. So you are watching, and let the emotions do whatever the emotions want. The emotion is a little animal, and the emotion will say, yeah, why this person does this to me, or doesn't do this, or I wish the person weren't alive, or wasn't alive, or whatever. The emotions are irrational. Now, we say, no, I shouldn't feel that. But that's fine for normal people, but for a spiritual person, you know, there are two possibilities. If you are trapped in the emotions, then you have to control them, because there are emotions that can lead you to harm a person. But if you begin to work on this state of awareness, you can let go of the control of the emotions and begin to watch it. I'm not saying you should go and do whatever your emotions want to do, because then you are here. Well, we are always here, so you have two routes. Or go back, and you know, sometimes these teachings are misinterpreted, and they say, let your inner child flow and don't repress yourself and let the emotions. Well, you are going back to this. Or the other interpretation, which I think is the spiritual interpretation, is yes, don't repress your emotions. Don't repress, but don't express them either. Just let them inside, do their play, and be aware of them. When you are aware of the emotions cannot touch you, because you are like above the emotions. So if there are negative emotions there, when you are in a state of awareness, those emotions are really not touching you. In Tibetan Buddhism, they call this state of awareness Rigpa. And they say when we are in a state of Rigpa, in this state of awareness, we are like a mirror. The mirror may reflect a saint or a monster, but the mirror is never tainted. It just reflects whatever is there. But it, you know, when that reflection is gone, the mirror is as pure as it ever was. So when we are in this state of awareness, our awareness is pure always. It may be reflecting negative emotions, but it's not being touched by them. So this is a help just to remain watching without reacting to the emotions or to the thinking. And it is only when, just as, you know, that ear that I was watching lost its concept, when I watched it for some time without trying to put the concept there, in the same way, when we are watching the emotions for a while without clinging to the intellectual process that tries to manipulate them, at a certain point, they are transformed. They disappear. What we thought was anger now just disappears, because our concept, this is anger, of course, there is an emotional movement there, but our concept, this is anger, is keeping it like an entity, just like the entity of an ear was being kept by my concept that is a year. But when we watch it and we can go to this non-intellectual perception, the emotion just disappears by itself. Sometimes it disappears little by little, And sometimes it disappears all of a sudden. So that happens with any person at any time. But as I said, we have to learn to tap into this intuitional awareness without being trapped in an intellectual awareness. So let us see some exercises that can help us tap into this awareness. Something that is recommended by some teachers is when we are in an emotional state, we can write down everything that is going on inside of us. It's a kind of journaling. Writing down produces several things. First, it slows down the process. When the process is too fast, it's very difficult to remain aware. It's like it goes so fast that it generates a gravity and our awareness is drawn into the process. But as it slows down, our awareness is able to maintain, independent from the process. So writing down is a way to slow down the process. When you write down, you have to write down everything without trying to control it, to manipulate it. It doesn't matter if you sound like a 15 years old girl. Just nothing against the girls. It's just like the archetype of, emotional thing. Just write down everything just as it is. And, as if somebody were dictating something to you and you just write it down without any judgment, without any control, without anything. Then when the problem is solved, when you are not in an emotional state anymore, you can go back and read it because you will learn how the emotions work. It's not how you work. It's how the emotions work. We are not the emotions. They are part of us, just like the body is part of us, but the emotions are independent from us. We can affect the emotions on different levels. As I said, we can affect the emotions intellectually, but then that produces conflict and more problems. When we enter in this state of intuitional awareness, then that very awareness, without we doing anything, puts order into the emotional state and the mental state. This is what many mystics talk or call the grace of God. They say it's the grace of God or the grace of the guru because they didn't do anything. It's not that they didn't do anything. They, as the thinker, as the person that is always trying to control, didn't do anything. But the very awareness is an action in itself. Many times when Krishnamurti would talk about this, people would say, but if there is something there, I have to do something about it. If I don't do anything, then nothing will happen. And he used to say, to see, to be aware, is to act. It's the deepest act that you can do. When you try to work on your emotions or your mind through your mind, you are working on the effects. But when you can let go of that and you stay in this state of awareness, you can uproot the problem. It's like if you want to see something deep in the water, in a lake. You need the water to be still. If there are ripples, then you will be all fragmented. You will see all fragmented. So if you can see the root of the problem, then you don't have to mess with it, with the process. In quantum physics, they say the observation modifies what is being observed because there is a unity behind everything. Well, that happens in consciousness. When you try to intervene in a process, you are modifying that. And therefore, you cannot, it's like what I was saying, you cannot see the root. You are, by that very fact, changing it. So when you write down, you can go back later and start learning how the emotions work. You don't need to say, I'm not going to do this anymore, or I will do this or that. Just be aware. See objectively how the emotions were reacting at the moment. That awareness will produce a little change inside. And little by little, that the very awareness will transform you. And you will keep reacting because, there is like an inertia. We gave an amount of energy to our emotions, and whether we like it or not, they have that energy there. So the reactions will keep on coming, but if you treat them with this awareness, those reactions, little by little, will tend to disappear. You stop producing new causes for new reactions in the future. So that's one of the I think the one of the first approaches that we can use that is pretty easy. Instead of going and complaining to somebody else and then worrying that other person, just start writing it, because we complain because we need to take all that pressure out. But when we talk, especially at the beginning, it's difficult to be aware. Once you learn, you can be aware even when you talk. But at the beginning, it's difficult to be aware. So writing it down is a good entry point, to be aware as you write it down and then later on. Now, then we should try to train ourselves also in watching. How to watch without in a passive way, without trying to modify what we are seeing, or without intervening. For example, go to a park. Start by training yourself on concrete things. Go to a park or whatever, you know, suppose you are in a park and you are watching the kids play and the parents there, and then comments will come to your mind. Isn't that person hot with this day and that clothing? Or that kid is going to hurt himself. Or, you know, whatever. Try to watch without making all these comments. Watch in a completely passive way, because that's the way you have to watch your emotions and your mind. And that's more difficult than watching something external, because it is affecting you. So first, we can learn by watching outside. When a comment comes, notice it and drop it. And again, try to watch without making a comment. I remember the first time I tried this, I said, this is impossible. And then I realized, if I cannot do it watching something that has nothing to do with me, it'll be very difficult to do it when I'm in the feet of an emotion, you know. So that's a good way to try to start learning how to watch in a passive way. Then you can start watching your motion, your body. It's easier to watch your body than your emotions and your mind. So if you are doing something mechanical, be it, you know, doing the dishes or walking in a park or eating a fruit, try to watch your body as if it were something completely different from you. You are watching from above. So you see how you move your hands, you see how you grab this or you move. Don't intervene in the process. Don't try to do it slower. Just let the body go, let the body act by itself, and you just watch it as if you were another person. Again, try to watch it without any trying to control it. You know, sometimes we have some automatic motions, or we play with a beer, or we move the, whatever we do. If you don't have a beer, I'm sorry, it's very amusing. So if you catch yourself doing that, let the body do it and watch it. Just watch it and see what happens. So the idea is begin to watch your body. As you learn to watch your body without trying to modify, without judging it, then you will be able to start watching your emotions and your thoughts. So, you know, after a while, start when you are in a, you know, when you have an emotional reaction, try to watch it without intervening. At the beginning, it'll be easier if the emotional reaction is not so strong. And there is always this boundary. You know, we have a certain ability at the moment to watch up to this level. When the reaction is too strong, we just forget. And I remember when I started doing this, I would walk a couple of blocks to the bus station. And I would say in the morning, okay, I will watch my body walking. And then when I was in college, I remember, hey, I said that I was going to watch my body. I completely forgot. And that for a month, you know, until one day I went out of my house and say, oh, I have to watch my body. So it's something that happens gradually. You have to do it as a game, not being frustrated that you cannot do it. It's like anything else. It needs practice. And if you take it lightly, not with ambition, with don't make a problem of this, you know, because we tend to make a problem of everything, even of that is supposed to solve problems. So just try to do it as a game, as a play with it. So now we are at the stage where we can watch our thoughts and our emotions. That's it's a pretty advanced stage. I don't want to say advanced because, again, this seems like a race or something of ambition, with ambition. But still, what I want to say, still is not the last step. Because while we watch our thinking, our emotions, who is the one that is watching? We are still, it's like you have the center of the what we call I, and to that center is associated the thinking process, thinking and emotions and all that. So what we are doing is beginning to watch the thinking and the feeling, but eventually we have to start watching the I. We have to start being not aware of thinking, but aware of being aware. That is the point where, you know, we started being aware of things that are out there. Then we start being aware of our body, our emotions, our thoughts. But now we have to be aware of ourselves, aware of the observe the observer. It is only then that the intuitional awareness has an open door to come. So if you practice this, at a certain moment, you will see that you get tired of watching. And when you relax the watching, sometimes the door is open and this insight comes. And when I say insight, I don't mean that you necessarily have a concept. Sometimes there is a concept and you say, whoa, I'm doing this. You just see it now. This is a problem. Or sometimes there is no concept and there is just a cessation of the reaction. But the point is that when we are watching our emotions as if we were different from the emotions or the thoughts, there is still duality there. We have to go and begin to watch the watcher, to be aware of the awareness. Now, all these kinds of instructions or tips, they are all kind of blurry until we start practicing it. The only the use of this is just like to have a map. You have a map of New Zealand. You are not going to know New Zealand through the map. But once you are there, the map may help you how to walk or where to go. So this is like a map, but you will really see what these things mean as you try to do them. At the beginning, you are always in darkness. You say, how can I do that? I don't know how to do it. Well, just try it. Just try. When you try to learn how to ride a bike, you don't know how to do it. You sit there, and then you fall. And you don't know previously how to do it. You learn in trying to do it. This is the same. This is all the same. So you try to be aware. You don't know how. You fail several times until one day, you know, you are riding the bicycle and you are not falling. How did it happen? You don't know, it just happened. So with this again, the same. So just try to do it and one day it will happen. So once you are able to watch, to be aware of awareness, then you begin to be more in touch with this insight. Now the insight comes whenever it wants. It's not that you can produce it. It's like you open the window and the breeze may come or may not. Now, if you don't open the window, the breeze will never come. So your duty is to open the window. And then sometimes the breeze will come. So the same with this. You become aware, and sometimes the insight will come. And sometimes it won't, but the very fact of being aware produces a transformation little by little that we don't notice necessarily outside. These are all processes that have to do on our inner nature, and we may not notice many things outside until you do. So that's more or less what I wanted to share, and we can discuss if there is anything that is not clear or that you think otherwise, we can discuss it.
Questions, wait for the microphone, please.
Something I heard maybe a couple months ago, a year ago, just because we think it doesn't mean it's true. But it's like, oh yeah. I always said that just because I think it's got to be true. But once I realized that, it's like, wow, that's a whole different kind of, you know, probably healthy to think that way. So mm-hmm.
we need to think, we need to feel, we need to act. Now, without awareness, these processes operate in more or less darkness. When there is this awareness, this more intuitive awareness, then these processes are still operating, but now they operate with more clarity. So I remember, for example, Schopenhauer, who was a philosopher, he used to say, we think we have free will because we can do what we want. But can you want what you want? In the sense of, you say, I want to do this. Were you the one that decided that you want that? Or that want is a result of a physical craving, an emotional craving, or a mental craving, and you think that it is you the one that wants that. So this seems just a play of words, but when you start being aware of this, the thinker, you begin to discover that it's absolutely true, that you are beyond that. And many times, most of the times, we are dragged into an action that we really don't want. So it's important, you know, this is just kind of the opposite to what in some spiritual movements is said, or even in psychology. And you have to understand when you can start working on this. If you don't have a more or less healthy psyche, a healthy, you know, ego, if you want to call it that way, then it's very difficult to work on this. You need to have a more or less healthy ego. The ego can never be completely healthy. The ego is a source of, unhealthiness. But there is a, you know, if you are more, you need certain balance. And if you are there, then you are ready to question all this. Because what we are doing here is questioning our feelings, our thinking, and many people feel threatened by that. They say, you are questioning me. You are questioning me if you are questioning my thinking. When, you know, many spiritual teachers are pretty harsh with people. In the New Age view, they are all peace and love, but in reality, there are many teachers that are pretty harsh, because they are attacking what is keeping you in a prison. You know, this that we always defend, this ego that we always defend and say, don't hurt me, don't treat me ill, that's what is keeping you in a prison, because we are far more than that. So when many spiritual teachers see that, they try to, you know, attack the ego with compassion. It's not the same as a person that is trying to hurt you. But all this implies that we have to start questioning our emotions, our mind, and yet that doesn't produce a lack of self-confidence. On the contrary, the self-confidence comes because we know that we want something, we want to be in a certain way, and we have the feeling that we can't. We don't want to be angry, and we are angry. We don't want to be fearful, and we are fearful. And that is the root of, to me, the lack of self-confidence. Because you see people who are great scientists or great artists or great businessmen, and many of them are arrogant because they are absolutely fearful, because they feel that they have to show people around that they are valuable, that they are good. So no achievement really brings real self-confidence. Achievements may bring arrogance, but not real self-confidence. The real self-confidence comes as you realize I'm beyond this. I'm more than this. I'm more than this mind and more than these emotions. And again, it's not that we have to deny them, but we have to put them in perspective. You know, it is said the ego is a very good servant, but it's a terrible master. So it's something like that. We thinking, feeling is perfectly fine as long as we are in control of them. The word control is tricky, but...
You know, what the gentleman just said, too, reminds me of the idea that, like what some of these non-duality teachers talk about is that, like Adyashanti says, that no thought is true. You know, it's like Krishnamurti said that once somebody labels something as a bird, you no longer see the bird. It's like that whole idea where we're looking at the concept but not the thing itself. So like the idea that no thought is true because it's the concept. It's not, you know, it's mm-hmm. one step removed. Mm-hmm. So it just made me kind of think of that too, like when I was talking about the thoughts.
Yeah, and you can see that's why I was putting this example of the words and all that. You know, since you mentioned... Well, you didn't mention Vedanta. You mentioned non-duality. I thought about Vedanta, which is a school in Hinduism. And they have this concept of the nirvitarka perception. Vitarka is our ability to make concepts, images. Nirvitarka is without that. So they say this non-dual perception can come only when there is a nirvitarka perception, when there is a perception devoid of conceptualization. And as we said, it's very difficult because that's a state of consciousness. You know, to perceive without the conceptualization is going to a higher state of consciousness. So through the right effort, little by little, we learn to rise above it. But the effort is in beginning to watch on whatever level, physical, emotional, thinking, without indulging in the process of labeling, judging, you know, this is good, this is bad, this is right, I like this, I like that. All those things will come when you watch, but then you have to recognize that it is not you the one that is saying, I like it. It's your mind. So then you again are aware. It's like your awareness is always going above any of the processes. You know, you are watching your mind. And then some thought comes and you say, I don't like it, or I shouldn't be thinking of this. And then another thought says, oh no, I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't label. And then you get trapped into that and you are trapped in the thinking. So if you are watching and there is a thought that comes and says, this is bad or I shouldn't be thinking of this, watch it. And then the other thought will come and say, what are you doing? You are supposed not to judge. Watch it. You know, just don't cling to any of that. That's the way that you, because it's very tricky. You know, we have the tendency to cling to one thought. So whatever happens there, just watch it and let it go.
It's okay when one is alone going through those reactions and reactions. When someone else says something and I don't agree, instead of responding, I need to pull back. It's so easier to respond and make judgments. Well, I don't agree with you, or this is a... Instead of really listening, it's the listening I find sometimes is weak. But not to respond immediately to what the other person is, to really have compassion, to think it out without taking it personally or whatever it is that you, I want to have an answer for it, and I don't. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is the ideal. Usually it's more difficult when the threat is right there, you know, when we are dealing with the situation. That comes in times, but it's easier if you start doing it, you know, away from the situation. Eventually, little by little, you begin to be able to do it in certain situations, and then in some others you can't, because it depends on how deep what is happening is touching you. You know, there are like different layers. So when the reaction is very deep, it's very difficult to be in this state of awareness, because it requires a lot of energy. So be ready to be able to do it sometimes and not be able to do it at some other times. Your genuine intention of doing it will do the work. So if today you cannot react in the right way in this situation, you just have to keep trying. And little by little, with the practice, you will gather more strength. And after a while, and a while may be some years, you will find that when put in that situation, now you don't react as before. So, you know, don't think about these things as all or nothing, because it's not like that. You know, the life is very complex. We are very complex. And then, so we can do it in some aspects, and in some other aspects, we need more strength.
I was just going to make a comment. Anyways, so thank you for the great presentation. Anyways, it seems that there are different views about this idea of awareness. And of course, this appeals very much to our theosophical perspective. But also coming from a Krishnamurtian background, I often hear Krishnamurti talking about this individual being non-fragmented, meaning that when we say, okay, we are not the thinking, we are not the emotions, we are not the body, we are something else, there itself we are making a fragmentation. We are not that, we are this. So how do we reconcile these two parts? Because it seems like there is another perspective of awareness in which you are in complete awareness as a whole, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Your emotions, your body, even your mind is absorbing this potentiality that observes or that listens or that mm-hmm. watches or that any other of our senses is all there present at that very moment. Mm-hmm. So it seems like with not attuned body, with not attuned emotional body, thinking body, so on, I find it very hard to achieve this altered state of awareness and you know, and act from there. So how do we reconcile? That's one question. How do we reconcile that?
Yeah, what you are mentioning, that happens here when you are aware of the awareness. And I have a quote of Nisargadatta, because Krishnamurti, in particular Krishnamurti, I remember a question that somebody asked to Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi was a Hindu jnani or sage, also of the non-dualistic philosophy, and they asked him about Krishnamurti. And he said, yes, Krishnamurti always talks about what is beyond. So Krishnamurti, for the most part, he doesn't talk of any of these paths, but he talks about like the ultimate state, which is when you are aware of the awareness. And you are right, that's the aim, how we can get there. And for example, Nisargadatta says, because Krishnamurti used to say, when the observer is the observed, there is no duality between the two. That's why I was saying, when we watch our thinking, our emotions, there still is a duality. We have to get to the point when we are aware of the awareness. So Nisargadatta, talking about that, says, this union of the seer and the seen happens when the seer becomes conscious of himself as the seer. He is not merely interested in the seen, which he is anyhow, but also interested in being interested, giving attention to attention, aware of being aware. So the union of the seer and the seen, what you were talking about, the observer and the observed, comes when there is this awareness of awareness. Now, that's a, as you said, that's a very deep state, which in my experience trying to, you know, to work on this and talking to other people, it's very difficult to get there right away. As Krishnamurti, you know, I personally like Krishnamurti very much. But he usually talks, you know, the highest step. He used to say the first step is the last step. And he stuck to that. You know, he wouldn't talk about previous steps. But I think beginning by, you know, the journaling, then watching outside, all that is a dualistic awareness. But little by little, we gain this ability to watch without reacting. And eventually, we have to come to this, to that state of awareness where there is only awareness. There is no difference, you know, between the observer and the observed.
At the beginning of your talk, you said something very important, actually. You were talking about education. Of course, you know, that concerns me very closely. And you said something crucial, that we were taught what to think, but we didn't learn how to think, more or less how to act, more or less how to feel. I think that that is a very question for all to question ourselves. Mm-hmm. And can we learn how to now? Mm-hmm. Is it a possibility?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I remember in college we had two teachers that wanted to teach us how to think and not what to think. And they were very resisted by most of the students because they didn't know how to deal with that. They just wanted, just tell me what I have to learn, what I have to repeat, and stop there. Yeah, that's easier. I always remember these two teachers. To me, they were great. One of them was a little crazy, but and he was very disappointed when I started going to the Theosophical Society. He said, "Oh, that's a disappointment. Now Sender is going to this thing. He should be a great scientist." And but I really appreciate him. He was a good teacher.
We do have a question from online. Isabella asks, will it lead to find who I really am or to forget about myself?
The question, who am I, is a central question in many philosophies. And for example, Ramana Maharshi, who I mentioned, his method was basically work on this question, who am I? Ask yourself, who am I? Now, the idea is not to give an answer, because who's giving the answer? You know, you can say whatever you want. Who am I? I am Atman. I am Brahman. I am God. But that answer in itself doesn't have much of a meaning. It has a meaning within a philosophical context. But here we are trying to discover who or what or we are. So the idea is the answer is not important. What is important is the fact of looking at ourselves. Because what Ramana Maharshi was trying to do when saying, who am I, is that you do this. You turn your attention on yourself. You know, in Zen, there is a koan who is reciting the sutra of the Buddha Amitabha, something like that. And the idea, the whole koan is centered on the who. You know, it's like saying, who is praying? In Christianity, we pray. Now, there is an exercise, or if we would copy this, the Zen exercise, it would be, who is praying? It doesn't matter, you know, what prayer you are saying. Who is the one praying? So the idea of who am I is a central question, but not to be answered, because the answer will be a concept. The idea is, use the question to look at yourself, to be aware of yourself, aware of the awareness.